From WIPR, I'm Sheila Kast. We're on the record. Sticker shock is the reaction of many families when they look at the cost of college, a number that doesn't even take into account textbooks or trips home for the holidays. Money Magazine senior writer Kim Clark walks us through why the cost of college keeps rising, as well as what to do when a financial aid package doesn't measure up. Plus, a new ranking looks at which schools do the best job of moving low-income students into the middle class.
We do take into account socioeconomic mobility, but we also take into account educational quality and graduation rate and the average earnings of alumni.
Which colleges in Maryland made the list? How can students make smarter choices when selecting a school? It's On the Record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Kast. We're On the Record. For many families, the summer months include trips to the pool, the park, the beach. For families of high school students, summer may also include visits to college campuses. And while the size and location of a school, its reputation, and the type of degrees it offers all play a role in choosing which college to attend, the deciding factor is often cost. According to the nonprofit College Board, which administers the Advanced Placement Program and the SAT, the average published tuition and fees for in-state students attending public four-year colleges rose by $6,500 from 1985 to 2015. Joining me by phone to talk about what families and students can do when the cost of college seems out of reach is Kim Clark, senior writer for Money Magazine. She writes about consumer finance with a particular focus on financial aid and paying for college. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
There's a lot of sticker shock when families look at the price of college. The most expensive private colleges can cost upwards of $50,000 a year, but few students actually end up paying that price. A survey by the National Association of College and University Business Officers found that just 12% of freshmen paid full sticker price at private colleges, one out of eight. On average, private college freshmen received grants to cover half their tuition. So is that sticker price essentially meaningless?
Well, first of all, the sticker price is really getting closer to $70,000 a year. I mean, if you look at Johns Hopkins and you're paying full price, you don't get any aid. It's really getting close to 70, so that's shocking.
Yeah.
But it's like the Macy's formula. You know, they put a high sticker price and then they give you a few thousand dollars, or in some cases a lot, you know, $10,000 or $20,000, and so you feel like you're getting a bargain, right? So at private universities, only about 12 or 13% of students actually pay those sticker prices. Although I do want to say that it varies by school. The more selective and elite schools can get more people to pay the higher price, because it's just like anything else, you know, supply and demand. There's a lot of demand for a Johns Hopkins degree, so there are a lot of wealthy students who are willing to pay that, wealthy families who are willing to pay those high prices. So at Johns Hopkins, it's probably more like 40% pay that full price or 50% pay that full price.
But if many more are not at other colleges, that indicates that colleges are coming up with more financial aid.
No, what it means is that colleges are raising their sticker price and then giving everybody, you know, it's this generation, everybody gets a scholarship, right? Everybody gets a
participation trophy.
A trophy, right? So there are schools in Maryland, and I haven't looked it up, but I'm going to guess that, you know, schools like Washington College and Goucher College probably give 90%+ of their students some sort of scholarship. And in some cases, I've actually heard college officials call them cocktail party scholarships, because they're, you know, $4,000 or $5,000, and that's enough to allow a parent to brag about it, you know, at a cocktail party. But when your sticker price is $55,000 or $60,000 or $65,000, you know, they give you a $5,000 scholarship and you're still paying, you know, $50,000 or $55,000. You're still paying a lot.
As a percentage, it's a small discount.
Right.
Are colleges, especially private colleges, competing more with financial aid for students?
Yes. So what's happened is, I think that private college sticker price tuition has just been rising and rising and rising. But now I think they finally hit the ceiling. And what you're seeing is more and more schools, as you mentioned, are giving more and more aid, so that the net price that families are paying, you know, after they subtract out the scholarships, is kind of flat at private colleges. For the typical private college, and I'm not talking about the super elite colleges, but just the typical private college, you're probably only going to pay maybe, you know, even though they have a high sticker price of, you know, more than $50,000, you're probably going to pay 30-something thousand a year. And we look in Maryland, you know, it's more like for a typical degree from a private school, maybe you're going to pay $130,000, which may sound like a lot, but, mm-hmm. you know, divided by 4 years, it's not so bad.
Is it that, I mean, I've always heard, for example, that international students tend to pay the full sticker price.
Right.
And there are fewer of them. Is there a change in who colleges can appeal to that's behind this?
Well, so what colleges have been doing is, you know, American students have a very difficult time, even to pay $30,000 or whatever, or $20,000, right? I mean, it's a lot. So what colleges are doing is recruiting rich kids from overseas who will pay, you know, $70,000, and they're taking some of that money from those rich kids and using it to subsidize the American students.
I'd like to understand, though, how much of the tuition picture across the country is shaped by the fact that there are now fewer college-age students, right? I mean, the children of baby boomers have kind of sort of moved through that pipeline.
Right. So this is actually an issue that's affecting especially the non-elite private colleges. The fact is that there was sort of a baby bust about 18 years ago or 20 years ago, and we're in the middle of a valley, kind of a demographic valley of students who are turning about 18 these days. So there's been a decline in the number of students who are applying to college right now. It's just a demographic quirk, right? And so a lot of expensive private colleges that aren't considered elite are really suffering, and these are the schools, you know, to try to fill their classes, and these are the schools that are really offering lots of scholarships, lots of aid, but they still have to pay their professors and to pay for the mowing of the beautiful lawns and so on. So they can't, you know, discount forever, but they are being very increasingly aggressive in terms of scholarships and aid. I mean, you were seeing that at Washington College. I mean, that was a comparatively expensive college that didn't have really great aid, and you had a new president come in, Sheila Bair, who really amped up the financial aid. I'm not sure what happened with her, but they're, you know, she's she's resigning, and so there's going to be a new president. But that was an example of a school that was being very, you know, really changing its strategy and trying to offer more aid.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with Kim Clark, senior writer for Money Magazine, about paying for college. What are some of the costs that students often fail to include when they're calculating the cost of college?
If you're going to live on campus, you really have to think about how much does a dorm cost? How much does a cafeteria contract cost? And you have to think about things like, if you live far from campus, how much will it cost you to get back from your home to the campus? If you're going to school across the country, you're going to spend a lot of money on plane tickets or train tickets. You know, I mean, you're going to spend a lot on that. And of course, there's always books, especially if you're in the sciences. Your textbook bill is going to be shocking.
How can students reduce some of the costs of
given
college?
Well, on textbooks, for example, you can rent a textbook. More and more students are doing that. You can buy used books, which is, I think, a great solution. Unfortunately, colleges often want you to, you know, buy the online version, which has all these tests and homework practice, and of course the publishers make that impossible to resell, so, you know, it's a code that you enter. If you are, for example, taking the train to and from home, Amtrak has a student discount, so you might want to join. They have a student program that you can join. And in terms of living on campus, you know, you might want to check, there's different levels of cafeteria plans, and if you never get up in time for breakfast anyway, maybe you don't need the 3-meal-a-day plan.
Sometimes financial aid packages include loans or money from work-study programs.
I think federal student loans are great. I mean, They have a very low interest rate. I mean, I think it's 4.5% for this coming year, which is, you know, I mean, you're an 18-year-old, you have no credit, and you're still getting a loan for 4.5%. That's a pretty good deal. Some of the schools are packaging parent loans, which I do find problematic. The federal parent loans, for example, have a fairly high interest rate. I mean, when you add in all the fees and everything, it's about 8%, which is not cheap right now. And you're not guaranteed to get them. They do a credit check, so if you have had a bankruptcy or a bind in other bills, you're not going to get it. So they shouldn't just assume that you're going to get this loan. And frankly, they award these loans. You're allowed to borrow up to the full cost of your student's attendance, your full net cost, and that means that families are taking on these huge debts. That mean that often the parents can't retire anytime soon, that they're risking their own retirement and financial stability. So I'm not a big fan of parent loans. I know that in some cases it's the only way the student can go to college, but I really encourage anyone who's looking at a parent loan to think of alternatives. You know, I mean, maybe go to a different college that's a little less expensive, or see if there's any other way that the student can make that funding work without burdening the parents with big loans.
Decode for us the difference between a federal subsidized loan and a federal unsubsidized loan.
I know. It's terrible, isn't it? I mean, the language that they use in financial aid, it's a whole other language, and it makes no sense outside of it. So there's basically three kinds of student loans. There's a private loan, which you just get from, you know, Sallie Mae or a bank or a credit union, and that is not subsidized at all. It's just a loan, a personal loan that you take out. And for those, usually they want a creditworthy cosigner like a parent. So even though it may be in the student's name, the parent is also on the hook. And then there are federal student loans. And as you mentioned, there's two kinds. And these, first of all, the parent is not responsible for, so that's a good thing for the parent. There are two separate kinds of loans, the subsidized and unsubsidized loans. The subsidized loans mean that you pay a slightly lower interest rate overall, because on the subsidized loans, the interest does not build up while you're in school. So by the time you graduate, it hasn't grown. I think you're only allowed to borrow $3,500 a year on the subsidized loan. So at the end of that time, you owe $13,000, whatever. But the unsubsidized loans, the interest does build up. So the difference is the subsidy is that the government is paying your interest while you're in school on those subsidized loans. But, you know, interest rates are 4%, so you're not paying. It's not a huge difference, you know, over those 4 years.
If you get a financial aid package but you're disappointed in it, what's the best way to appeal?
Oh, yeah, appealing is a great thing to do. If you are a parent of a rising high school senior, you should definitely think about this. Your kid should apply to several colleges because, you know, you want to, I like to call it creating like a financial aid eBay situation. You want people bidding for your student, right? So you want to have some affordable colleges in your mix. You want to have some University of Maryland campuses, and you want to have some private colleges, including one or two maybe where your student is at the top of the class. You know, you can look at various sites like ours or the U.S. Department of Education's Navigator and see what the average SAT score is. And then hopefully your student will get into several of these. And then you can start to compare offers. And if you narrow it down to one or two that, you know, these are our finalists, then if one, your favorite, is more expensive, you know, on a net basis than some other ones, then you just want to call and say, hey, you know, College A thought that our need or our merit was worth this. And, you know, is there anything we can do to provide you with information that might make you see it the same way?
Is this usually updating information you've already given the college?
That can certainly work, but I know that when I talk to financial aid officers, a lot of them hate the idea of negotiating, like, you know, making it like a used car lot situation. So one of the ways to do it nicely so that they're not feeling kind of, you know, like they're negotiating is just to say, gee, you know, this other school thought that our family could only afford X. You know, why do you think we can afford more? Is there anything we can provide to you that would show that we need more aid? I mean, so make it not just a hardball negotiation.
We got to take a quick break here. Kim Clark of Money Magazine is going to stick with us. When we're back, a new ranking by Money Magazine looks at which colleges do the best jobs of helping students move from low-income families into upper middle class. A few Maryland colleges show up on that list, and not necessarily the ones you'd guess. Stay with us.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking today about the cost of college, how to decode your financial aid package, and what to do when that offer doesn't quite measure up. With me is Kim Clark, senior writer for Money Magazine. Kim, your magazine released a new set of rankings this morning based on which colleges do the best jobs of helping students move from low-income families into the middle class or the upper middle class. Why look at economic mobility as opposed to how many students get jobs in their field or their starting salary or some other factor?
Well, first of all, we actually do take into account some of those things. We do take into account socioeconomic mobility, but we also take into account educational quality and graduation rate and the average earnings of alumni and things like also student loan repayments. So we're kind of amalgamating all the data that we can find that indicate how well alumni do after they graduate or after they leave school, in addition to the basic, you know, quality indicators that are available. And we would love to include more information, such as you mentioned, such as what percent get jobs in their field or even what students are learning or how well they're learning. But in many cases, there's just no data available. I mean, nobody has figured out how to measure learning, for example. So we're just using the best data we can find, the best data that's available, and doing the best we can with what's out there. And I think that socioeconomic mobility is really so important, and it's becoming such a hot issue these days that we're using new data developed by an economist by the name of Raj Chetty, who's out of Stanford, and he's posted all this incredible data on socioeconomic mobility that you can see on the Equality of Opportunity Project. You can Google for that online. And we just used his data to look at which colleges are taking low-income students and helping them by the time they're age 34 into high-paying jobs. We think that's really important.
So which schools took the top spots?
A lot of schools, you know, very elite, expensive schools, take in like 10 low-income students, and then they do a really great job with those low-income students. We're looking at also at how many schools are giving opportunities to low-income students and moving them in. So, I mean, it's not just about whether they do a good job with a few students. We want schools that do a good job with lots of students, right? The two top schools in terms of that are an aeronautics school in New York, where apparently every student graduates with a great job. It's called Vaughan Aeronautics. And the number two school in the country would be Baruch, which is a City University of New York college, and they have a lot of low-income students, and those students seem to do really well in the job market.
That's Kim Clark, senior writer for Money Magazine, here on the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about paying for college, and we're talking about how colleges affect the outlook for low-income students. So summarize for me what or how Maryland colleges show up in your finding.
Right. One of the things we do is we analyze each school's data, like graduation rates, student loan repayment rates, alumni earnings, and we use statistical techniques to measure how that school does compared to schools that take in very similar students. Because, you know, of course Johns Hopkins has a very high graduation rate. I mean, they take in only A-plus students. But when you compare it with other schools that take in similarly elite students, how does it do, right? And so we find, for example, that Bowie State, you know, takes in lots of low-income kids, gives a lot of opportunity, and does a great job of graduating those kids. I mean, it does a way better job than schools with similar admissions policies. So we think that Bowie State is a really terrific opportunity for people. The other thing we look at is earnings. And, for example, University of Maryland, Baltimore County, those students tend to earn more than similar students at other schools. So there's a premium, we think, in the job market for those kind of for UMBC graduates. You know, the public colleges here in Maryland offer a great education. I mean, University of Maryland at College Park is a top-notch school, and it has very generous financial aid. Our calculation actually is that since more than 50% of the University of Maryland students get some financial aid, it's actually the most affordable college in the state.
And how about Loyola University?
Oh, Loyola University, right. Terrific. First of all, Loyola University is, you know, expensive, but its graduates seem to do very, very well in the job market. And so they, when you compare Loyola University against schools that take in similar students, have similar percentages of low-income students, and students with similar test scores, they earn much more than the average.
This spring, you wrote about a report by the Institute for Higher Education Policy that highlighted how unaffordable college is for working and middle-class students.
Right.
Just 40 schools nationwide provide enough aid or have such low tuition that they are affordable without loans to students from families earning less than $36,000 a year, provided the student works part-time and the family has set aside some savings. You look at that and what conclusion do you draw? Is college still worth it?
Oh, well, first of all, college is absolutely worth it. I mean, if you look at the unemployment rate for college graduates versus those who don't attend college, if you just open, you know, monster.com or any of the job sites, I mean, the job openings for non-college people without any college education are limited. I mean, you're without college right now, it's really hard to get a good job. I mean, you don't get benefits, you don't get retirement, you don't get health care. I mean, you need some sort of post-secondary education. Now, it doesn't have to be a bachelor's, but you need something. You need a welding certificate. You need some sort of, you know, something, some skill to help you in the job market. The data is so clear that a high school degree just isn't enough anymore. Secondly, it's getting very expensive. I mean, definitely. College is definitely expensive. And what's happened is states have not contributed as much to their public colleges as they used to in the past. And as a result, the colleges are pushing more and more of the costs onto the students. And for example, I mean, the most affordable for low-income students, the most affordable college in this state, in Maryland, is University of Maryland at College Park. And even for the lowest income students, on average, they expect you to take out a student loan of about, you know, $5,000 or so. And to contribute something from earnings. So pretty much you're going to have to borrow. You're going to have to borrow to afford college. But if you leave University of Maryland at College Park with $20,000 or $25,000 in student loans, you're in such a much better shape in terms of your long-term career and economic opportunities that it's worth a small amount of loan, you know, as long as you keep it to that amount to get that degree. I mean, it's definitely worth it. It's a risk, but it's worth it.
Kim Clark, I really appreciate your sharing your perspective on all this with us. Thank you so much.
You bet.
Kim Clark is a senior writer for Money Magazine. At the On the Record page at WIPR.org, links to some of Kim Clark's recent articles about college affordability, as well as the new rankings on economic mobility and a tool that allows you to build your own rankings by selecting what factors matter to you, from merit aid to location to expected earnings or debt. We also have a link to the Equality of Opportunity Project based on the research at Stanford University we discussed. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.